It's member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, all things considered, and I'm Dave Lawrence, among the world's finest guitarists, joining us ahead of his dates, September 6th through the 9th. Blue Note bringing his Elegant Gypsy 40th anniversary tour. Huge thrill to welcome Al Di Meola to the show. Brother Al, thank you so much for doing this.
Oh, my pleasure. We're really happy to be coming back. Jeez, it's got to be more than 20 years.
Unbelievable. Well, a huge...
I know.
I've read that at an early age, you knew you wanted to play guitar.
Well, it was probably due to my sister, who's 7 years older than I was, bringing home all of these recordings, 45s, vinyl discs. And I think it was a party she had at the house. Some of her friends brought over their amps and guitars, and that was the first time I actually touched the instrument. And I knew right then I wanted to take guitar lessons. A smart move.
Before discovering Larry Coryell, had you already started working on that speed and precision, or was it really finding his music that pushed you forward?
It was a period in my mid-teens where I started to like bluegrass music, and I was listening to those speed pickers like Doc Watson and that kind of precision playing. I got so into country music at one point that I actually switched to pedal steel and dropped guitar. And then I quickly realized all those years that I had studied the guitar will go down the drain, so I then gave it up and got back into it. So right around the age of 15 or 16, I got my first taste of early fusion, and then I delved completely into jazz. Now, my early training when I was 8 and 9 years old was from a jazz guitar player. I was learning a lot of the standards and a lot of the things that had to do with jazz, even though I didn't want to, even though I was listening to The Ventures and The Beatles and all of that early pop stuff that I still love today.
What was the first concert you went to?
The Rascals.
Not a surprise in that area.
You know who they were?
Felix Cavalieri.
Yeah, Cavalieri, yeah. I was definitely 14 because at 15, I had the great opportunity of going out west with my mom to California. And by myself, I went to the Fillmore West. It was like a dream of, you know, all of my friends. We were going to the Fillmore East quite often. That inspiration was, you know, part of my education. The Fillmore West was where it all began.
Berkeley. How long did you actually study there before you got the Return to Forever gig?
A little less than a year, semester and a half, 73 to 74. When I went there, Dad asked me to teach. I wasn't interested in that. But while I was there, I went to see Return to Forever, which was at the time one of the two of my favorite bands. I loved the Beatles, but Return to Forever was the other band filling in for Bill Connors. They had Earl Klug. So I had mentioned to a friend of mine, you know, they have Earl Klug in the band, and he's kind of out of place. Great guitarist, but out of place. He's primarily acoustic player. And he took it upon himself, this friend of mine, to find Chick and hand-deliver him a tape of my playing.
And back then, what were you listening to that helped shape or influence that heavy guitar tone?
I like the Allman Brothers. I like Santana. I like when Mahavishnu Vishnu came on the scene. John was using that Les Paul through a Marshall sound, so that was the bridge for me. So fusion was. It was the bridge between rock and jazz.
And those tones were not common anywhere else in jazz. That's why I guess I pointed them out. And later, thinking about guitar tone, you ended up getting to interact with Les Paul himself, who guested on Splendido Hotel.
Well, he lived pretty close to me in New Jersey. I had met him at a show that I was doing. In fact, it was the first show with my band after Return to Forever broke up. 1976, I was about 21. I had my first show at the Beacon Theater, and it was a big event for me. I'm in my dressing room. I'm warming up on my Black Les Paul. And then I hear a voice from the back of me. Hey, what kind of guitar is that? And I said, it's a Les Paul. As I turn around, and there's Les Paul. Before I said Paul, there he was.
It's incredible.
Yeah, yeah. And I nearly fainted. You know? Since then, we had become, in those years after, quite good friends. He invited me to his house. He came over to my house many times. He couldn't get over the right hand picking technique that I had. He would literally get down on the floor and study my right hand. He says, I just can't understand how you do that. My house. And he began studying my right hand. Look at this. This guy, you know, he invented recording, multi-track recording, and reverb.
And there he is studying your picking technique.
Yeah, yeah. It was like, you know, out of a dream.
So you really developed quite a rapport, I guess, by the time that June 11th, 1987, 72nd birthday happens with you and Jimmy Page and Tony Bennett, Jeff Beck, Rick Derringer. By the time that happened, you were tight friends.
Oh, yeah, 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 very much so.
kind of like when Frank Zappa invited you to do a gig with him in New York.
Yeah. The night before, he calls me. I had never talked to him before, but I was a fan, seen him many times at the Fillmore East, and I never thought in a million years that Frank Zappa would be calling me. I just remember watching TV, and I, hello? Hi, Al, this is Frank Zappa here. And I go, oh, my God. Yeah, it definitely was Frank right away. You get that deep voice.
Right.
Look, I wrote this song that I'd love for you to come down and play with us tomorrow night. We'll be at the Ritz. I said, I'm there. So I went down to the sound check. He had it all written out, and I just sight read it.
The only time that you ever ended up playing with him?
That was the only time, and a good experience.
A cat that we've mentioned him before, but considering how important he factors into your development, and only through this interview did I really realize it, was John McLaughlin.
Yeah. We were label mates. Ma Vishnu was on CBS. I might have met him at a concert, and I might have seen them, and then we met maybe backstage, perhaps. But then, just a couple of years later, I was approached first by this impresario, like an agent, who happens to be McCartney's guy right now. But he started in the business with us. But he first approached me and Paco to do a trio with Leo Kottke.
Wow.
Yeah, and I was like, wow, that would be cool, because I had that little country period where I was listening to Leo.
Right.
I thought it was kind of odd, but this is interesting. I was a big Leo fan and a Paco fan. Of course, Paco had already recorded on my album, and we had talked about the idea of doing something together. But it wasn't until about a month before we were to get together that Barry Marshall, who was the impresario guy, he called me and said, hey, what's your thoughts on John McLaughlin instead of Leo? I said, well, if you get John, between John, myself, and Paco, you're going to have a powerhouse trio. And it's exactly what happened. We did a two-month tour starting in Europe, and we ended in San Francisco. We recorded a lot of shows, but we were playing almost every night. So our chops were like beyond ridiculous. You know, I listen to those records now, and I go, I don't know if I could do that anymore. But, you know, it was just 2 months of healthy competition is how I would term it. There was a really good dialogue, and we were really trying to impress one another. And in turn, the audience got a blast out of it. One guy took a solo, and it was like mind-blowing. It's like, oh, shoot, now it's my turn. I got to come up with something that I've never done before. In turn, provided the recording that eventually came out. It's Friday Night in San Francisco. It still is a landmark recording.
It kind of brings everything full circle to end on that note, because when you think about it, Al, that trip to San Francisco, such an important thing when you were so young, going to not just San Francisco, but Bill Graham's venue, and then all those years later, Friday Night in San Francisco, to watch Bill introduce you guys on stage, that in and of itself, I'm just guessing, maybe not, but that had to be a pretty monumental thing, because that was the guy from the Fillmore.
Monumental beyond words, because I was just this 14, 15-year-old kid going to the Fillmore East, and I would see Bill out on the sidewalk, and the hippies, we were all hippies back then, everybody was into paying almost nothing for a ticket. And they were all accusing him of being this kind of off ticket guy, just a capitalist pig. And they were calling all kinds of names. And he would fight back. And I'll never forget that. I watched this guy. And if it wasn't for him, these acts wouldn't be there. And I couldn't understand why the people online were like screaming at him, yelling at him. I'll never forget it. And here it is years later, him introducing me and Paco and John. I always had great respect for this guy. Just a great man.
Was that the only time you ever had a real personal kind of professional experience with him?
Well, I've been to his office many times. We've hung out. He's called me at home many times. Santana, if they were playing in New York, he would call me at the house. Hey, Al, why don't you come down? Carlos would love for you to sit in. I was like, whoa, I just can't. This is like a dream come true. And that was still when I was still in my 20s.
You had a lot of dreams come true. If there's any way you'd be willing to do a brief follow-up interview or something when you come to town,
sure.
That would mean
let's do it.
The world.
Yeah, I'm there a number of days, so I'll be glad to. I enjoyed it a lot. We should continue it when I get there.
We will, for sure.
A lot to talk about.
There is. Thank you so much for talking to us today.
My pleasure, Dave.
Al DiMeola.
Talk to you soon. Hi, this is Al DiMeola, and you're listening to my good buddy Dave Lawrence.